Compared to 2020, navigating 1998 was like frolicking through a meadow. However, when it was happening, it was kind of a bonkers year. The Unabomber was happening, Seinfeld ended. I was in my 20s then, and it felt like every single person I talked to was a millionaire from some sort of dot-com. And in addition to all that, all anybody talked about when they weren't talking about stock options was Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton's semen, Monica Lewinsky, Monica Lewinsky's dress, Linda Tripp, Ken Starr. The whole year was just, huh? If you had a propensity for needing to escape reality, it was the sort of year that wasn't going to diminish that propensity. In August 1998, my then-fiancé, now-wife, and I moved to New York, and I started teaching high school English at a public school in Manhattan. I came equipped with syllabuses filled with Langston Hughes, Zora Neale Hurston, Toni Morrison, Henry Louis Gates. I was positive I was going to teach their children their voice and save them from self-annihilation. In my head, it was that thing where one half of you is Sidney Poitier in To Sir With Love, and the other half of you is that thing of when Michelle Pfeiffer says in Dangerous Minds, there are no victims in this classroom. First few months were chaotic and disorienting and exciting and fun and difficult and challenging, but I loved it. I loved being in that world, loved meeting the kids. It was clear, though, that teaching the kids their voice was going to be more difficult than I thought. In addition to all of the regular teenage stuff, like the prom and acne and self-esteem, these kids, and they told me this in essays they wrote and stories they wrote, had to deal with so much. Neighborhood violence, rapey uncles, drugs, gangs. It was a lot. December rolled around, and the hard days became more frequent. Christmas in New York is really hard for kids. All the Barney's windows and the Rockefeller ice skating rink and the FAO Schwartz and that Mariah Carey song coming out of every orifice can really do a lot to a person when you realize that that's not my life. So when the wedding man called us on our landline and left a message on our answering machine that a band we were considering hiring for our wedding reception was playing a gig at a Christmas party, I was happy to volunteer. The band, Groove Bus, was playing a Christmas party on a Thursday night at Windows on the World at the top of the World Trade Center North Tower. I took the subway down there, took the elevator upstairs, and it was just surreal. It was a clear night. You could see for hundreds of miles. It was beautiful. Groove Bus played your wedding reception standards, your Donna Summers, your Coolin' the Gangs, your Commodores. And everywhere you looked, there was that thing of when the administrative assistant is wearing the earrings with the Christmas present and they're sitting on the sketchy businessman's lap and something sketchy was happening just everywhere you looked. So it was a perfect place to just get shit-faced. And when I wanted to feel fancy and get shit-faced, I drank gin and tonics. I drank a ton. And details are fuzzy. But at some point, took the elevator back down to the subway, hopped on the 4, 5, or 6 train, took it back uptown, passed out, pissed my pants, and ended up walking around the Bronx at around 1 a.m. I must have gotten kicked off the train. I didn't have an extra pass. I didn't have any money. Every place was closed. My piss-soaked jeans were starting to freeze to my leg. And just as I was about to get frightened, I heard somebody say, "Mr. Gary?" So I look around, and there's a student of mine, a student, Caesar, and he's standing in the doorway of this laundromat, and he says, what are you doing here? I'm like, what are you doing here? He explained to me that he, at night, he washes his mom works two jobs, and at night he washes his mom's uniforms so she can take the job, the uniform for a second job to work with her at her first job. It was clear he knew the state I was in, so he said, why don't I take you home? So the dryer bell dinged, we walked to his house, he ran upstairs, woke up his uncle. His uncle comes downstairs, and just as nonchalantly as you would in normal circumstances, he said, hi, Mr. Gary, nice to meet you. So the three of us walked to the uncle's car, and I just opened the door, and this is what always sticks with me. I didn't ask if he had a plastic bag I could sit on or a magazine. I just plopped down in my piss-soaked jeans in his car, and he drove me home. I went home, threw my jeans in the garbage chute, got a few hours of sleep, woke up, and was convinced my life, as I knew it, was over. I was going to get fired. The wedding was going to be off. I knew what I would have done in high school had I seen my English teacher in the state that I was in. Although my high school English teacher was a nun, so that would have been, anyway. Walked to school, first period, second period. Caesar walked into my third period class, nodded. I nodded back, and that was it. He didn't tell anybody. And then, so you know that thing of when teachers say, the kids are teaching me more than I'm teaching them, and you're like, you're full of crap. I'm teaching them more. Well, in this case, Caesar really did teach me more than I taught him. I learned that I was probably never going to be the sophisticated New Yorker that I thought I was destined to be. I learned that I was neither Sidney Poitier in To Sir With Love or Michelle Pfeiffer in Dangerous Minds. I wasn't even Sandy Bullock in The Blind Side. The kids were saving me. I was more like Walter Matthau in Bad News Bears. And in my head, I was really kind of like Hans Gruber in Die Hard or the villain in 1998's highest grossing film, Titanic, Cal Hockley. I was convinced I was just a shitty person. And that's what shame does. And I had always conflated guilt and shame. But I learned guilt is when you do something bad. You say, oh, I did something bad. I got over it. Shame is when you do something bad and you tell yourself you did it because you were a shitty person. And I was convinced after the entitlement it took to sit on this guy's seat in piss-soaked jeans, the shame from what I did that Thursday night, the shame from the whiplash of realizing I was not who I thought I was. The only way to overcome that really was to forget about it and to keep drinking, which lasted for a few years until I started telling people the story. And I guess in today's parlance, it's called leaning into your shittiness or owning it. But once you start telling people the story, you can't be ashamed that you're, or I couldn't be ashamed that I was a shitty person anymore, because if you tell the person the story and they're still standing there, then they might not think you're so shitty, which is helpful. Another thing that happened is you tell somebody the story and they would say, oh, that happened to me once too. Or, and this might say more about me, but a lot of people say, that happens to me all the time. In fact, at this point, when I meet somebody and they haven't pissed their pants on a New York City subway or a transportational vessel of any kind, I'm like, what's wrong with you? Caesar's a grown-up now. He's married and has kids. He does the same job his uncle did back in 1998, which is asbestos abatement. I'm not certain I taught him his voice. I'm not certain I taught him anything, even though he got an A that year. But he does know that he did change my life as I knew it, and I'm very grateful for that. Thanks.